You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Greetings and good evening. This is Tabitha, and you are listening to White Wellness. Hope everybody is doing well since last week. And as usual, I'd like to start with some news stories. So this is a topic that I pretty much talk about every week, but I think it's interesting to see how it's progressing so rapidly, and that's tranny meat. So a little bit of news on that front is Chick-fil-A. That's that chicken restaurant run by a very Christ-hearted man who's staunchly against homosexuals. They are going to now be offering a vegan chicken option. Chick-fil-A is the latest fast food chain to launch vegan options. The chicken chain says it's exploring meat-free menu ideas beyond salads and sides. So they're going to be doing some type of a tranny burger, apparently. And here is a little story. Chick-fil-A is the latest fast food chain to announce it's working on vegan options. The chicken chain told Business Insider that it's in the, quote, early stages of identifying meatless options, including vegan chicken. We're definitely aware, and I would say we're always interested in what's happening in food, says a executive director of Chick-fil-A. Specifically, a vegetarian option or a vegan option is something we're looking at, we're thinking about, and have some research and development. The chain has been heavily criticized recently for its funding of anti-LGBTQ organizations. Documents obtained by Think Progress revealed that Chick-fil-A donated $1.8 million in 2017 to groups with, quote, a discriminatory record against the LGBTQ community, noted by CNN. But despite the public backlash, Chick-fil-A, with more than 2,200 locations, is still on track to become the third largest fast food chain in U.S. sales this year. They already offer a number of vegan options, which are obviously not something I would eat, waffle fries, hash browns, superfood sides, and a recently launched kale salad. This just keeps on expanding more and more. First, they have the burgers, and now the chicken, it looks like. So the second story about tranny meat that I had are now that the Wu-Tang Clan are being used to push one of these tranny burgers, and 80% of them are now doing a plant-based diet. So they're being used to push this Impossible Burger that now White Castle is using in their little slider sandwiches. So here's the story on that one. Staten Island's most famous export, the Wu-Tang Clan, didn't just turn hip-hop on its head a quarter century ago. They redefined music and what music meant again and again. And they may be able to disrupt another industry, food. Specifically, they've become critical voices about shifting away from meat, dairy, and eggs. Let's see, they're getting into healthier living. They're saying that RZA was the first one to go vegan. They mentioned that they're saying it's Southern food, particularly, you know, kind of like the black Southern food diet. They're saying that's a slave man's diet. That's what they're writing here. That diet really isn't very healthy. So here's a picture on Instagram of two of them promoting this Impossible Burger, which is just going to be a smaller version because it's the White Castle burger of the Impossible Burger that other restaurants are showing. But that's about that. And this story just like to keep abreast on what's going on in this. Not that I'm interested in eating these foods, but still it's just interesting to see just how rapidly something so unhealthy is growing, but I shouldn't be surprised. Now, the next thing I wanted to mention is kind of one of the main topics for this evening, and that's white people's diets and what other people believe are white people's diets and what are actually authentic white food or European food. So as I was searching for this, I just typed in, I think, white people's diet or white food into Google. And of course, one of the first links I got was how white people's diet more than black or mestizo people is killing the environment. Ridiculous, crazy stuff. But this article is claiming that white people's eating habits produce the most greenhouse gases. And here is a little video featuring made by a black guy. His name is Joe Bozeman. And here's what he has to say about how white people's diets are killing the environment.
Our food preferences have a direct impact on the environment. However, previous research has largely ignored the role that demographics play. My colleagues and I have addressed this problem by performing a study on climate change adaptation as it relates to food consumption. What was interesting was that we found different racial groups affect the environment differently. While whites affect the environment the greatest in things like greenhouse gas and water, blacks affect the environment the most in land. Our take-home message is this. Scientists and policymakers should consider socio-demographic factors from the onset because one size does not fit all.
Okay. Well, I felt we were all the same. This guy said he should consider population demographic. And they also mentioned that blacks being the least efficient with land. So nowhere in the headline of the article is that mentioned, of course. And of course, this whole greenhouse or these, you know, greenhouse emissions, climate change, this is all geoengineered hoaxes. They're just kind of foisting onto us. No surprise there. So I just want to read up on this little article that further discusses what that video just did. And here goes. White individuals disproportionately affect the environment through their eating habits by eating more foods that require more water and release more greenhouse gases through the production compared to foods that the black and the Latinx, they're using that that tranny word now for mestizo population, where it's the word Latin, capital L, and an X, because I guess Latino denotes a male and Latina denotes a female. So now they're using this ridiculous word. What Black and Latinx individuals eat, according to a new report published in the Journal of Industrial Ecology. So where do they even get this data? And if we're using more water, I mean, it just seems ridiculous. It says that white people require 7% more water, they're saying, than at 328 liters per year than Latinx individuals who require 307 liters per year of water, while Blacks eating habits depend on about 12% more land use than other populations, which is driven by their higher consumption of chickens and apples, which are high land use items. Whites tend to drink more water and milk. Milk itself requires a lot of water to produce when you consider livestock cultivation. This is part of what we think is pushing their water impacts higher. If this is just a U.S. study, it could possibly be just demographic numbers, just with a white population. They can just be, you know, not saying that and then making the data look like we're being irresponsible. So again, of course, you know, everyone, the environment and all this stuff is blamed on our eating habits. Seems like most of the articles that I was going to find about white food, they were all anti-white stuff. It's like when I first started looking for white yoga stuff back when I did that yoga show months back, everything I found was about how yoga was too white or that it was racist. It's always what you're not looking for, but these days it's not expected to see it. And the second story I had is from this woman, a black woman, seems like she's pretty angry, I would say. And the name of the article is White People's Food is a Real Thing. And by white people's food, they're not talking about traditional European cuisine. They're talking about foods that have basically caught on as pop, mostly in this country, but also in other countries that I guess have been marketed to everybody, but I guess they mostly use whites in the advertisements. Of course, we know who's doing most of the marketing. It's Jews. But again, we're being blamed for this. So this article, again, is called White People's Food is a Real Thing. And this was written back in September. My editor read an article about how some African Americans struggle with the concept of eating so-called healthy food because all the, quote, good food is white people's food. I agreed with the sentiment and said, oh yeah, white people's food is totes a thing, because I mean, why would you willingly eat rice crackers? They don't have any taste. Well, first off, rice crackers are a Japanese food, so that's a fallacy right there. And they do have taste if you purchase the right ones. As a young black person raised by her grandma in a village, you probably never heard of my diet has always been pretty standard. You know, the basics, pap. I'm not sure what pap is. It says pap with red meat or chicken, maybe a stew. I think a lot of African dishes tend to be stew-like, which is usually cooked with water and salt, is only added if you're feeling funky. Add a bit of Raja spice and voila. Most of the time, there are no veggies on the side because things like cabbage, potatoes, and tomatoes and onions are standalones. As in, you have one of these with pap and that's your full meal. Never with the meat, no. Okay, so they're basically saying they have like a simple meat stew and then a vegetable dish on the side. Okay, this, of course, the exception is that usually a Sunday lunch, which is every plate of rice and seven colors of a massive vegetable salad. She's just describing her particular diet, which sounds pretty much like a lot of the trendy food that could be eaten here. Let's scroll down. Okay, the standard of living in Mzansi, it's a part of Africa, decreed long ago was that we were meant for basics. Luckily for us, unlike African Americans, our diet isn't just fried chicken and collard greens, which apparently is high in what's making it unhealthy. Also to point out, there's plenty of whites who eat fried chicken and collard greens too, who grew up in the South. So I wouldn't say those particularly black foods. They're just kind of more Southern foods, if anything. Our people have always had healthy-ish food. But one thing we really don't compromise on is taste. I guess get to the good part of this article. Okay. Despite the fact that we don't even know half the food nutritionists tell us to eat in order to lead healthier lives, we just don't see ourselves chilling in a restaurant ordering a side salad as the main. So since you don't know a lot of the foods that nutritionists tell you to eat and you wouldn't order a salad in a restaurant, somehow it's white people's fault. Or swapping out normal milk for almond milk. As for black people, the folks responsible for marketing cottage cheese, sweet potato crisps, rice crackers, and soy yogurt with unsalted pistachios never included us. Well, like I said earlier, that would be Jews who are behind marketing, not whites. Besides that, our budget doesn't stretch that far. It was decided long ago that black people would be the face of fried chicken over lean meat. Well, I know plenty of white people who struggle to eat healthy and afford it, so I don't think just black people have an issue with affording food, so I think that's pretty unfair to say. The first time I learned about quinoa was in 2016. I was 22 and it was for a university project. So me walking into a restaurant ordering a fancy, another word for white people food, salad is never going to happen. Okay. Let's see. Now basically when she was mentioning quinoa too, I mean, that's an Incan or Peruvian food. I mean, there definitely is some truth to whites having some roots in Central and South America. But as of recent history, that's been associated with Incan. So that's not really technically a modern white food. So yeah, again, you can just see she's just angry and blaming a lot of this on whites, which is really nonsensical and frankly, really ridiculous. All right, moving along with this topic of white food. Seems to be a lot of articles about this, you know, just making fun of white people's food. It's weird. First, some articles will say that white people's food is bland and has no taste. And then other articles will say they don't know anything of what it is and it's too fancy. So it seems like they pick an answer that's convenient for themselves to make themselves look like a victim, depending on what the angle is. White people food is creating an unattainable picture of health. That's a perception in the Black community that eating healthy means eating like white people, but doesn't have to be that way. It truly doesn't. This is just all really ridiculous stuff. And here they mention in this article, they mention Goop, which is Gwyneth Paltrow's magazine. She's a Jewess, obviously. They talk about healthy eating, $9 bottles of cold pressed kale juice. I don't know that many white folks that have money for a $9 bottle of kale juice. So this seems to be like a really small, I guess, group that they're talking about. This is not daily people who care about their health, or even those who don't care about them, their health. So I'm going to just read a little bit of this article. And this is, of course, on the Huffington Post, so it would have an anti-white leaning. Tanisha Gordon doesn't see what white people love so much about cottage cheese or salads, especially when they're topped with fussy ingredients like candied almonds or pickled carrots or Brussels slaw. Gordon is a 37-year-old employee at an IT company in Washington, D.C. So it says recently she was eating a diet of just fast, gross food like McDonald's and Taco Bell. Then she was diagnosed with diabetes. And then she battled the perception that most of today's healthy food is white people food. So because she was eating basically just total crap at a fast food restaurant, she did that because she was battling the perception of white people's food, making an excuse for everything. A lot of the time when you go to restaurants now, they have these little extravagant salads with all these different ingredients in it, like little walnuts and pickled onions, like the stuff Panera sells. For me personally, that's like a white person's food. A lot of mainstream stuff that's advertised comes across as being for white people. But many cultures around the world use onions and walnuts. I don't think those are particularly white ingredients. I mean, they are used abundantly in Europe, but they're also used in many other countries as well. These people are just dumb, essentially, just really just retarded. And of course, they're taking it out. They're lashing out on us. You've got the dominant culture in the USA being white culture. Black restaurateur Dr. Baruch Ben Yehuda, this doesn't sound black to me, told Huffington Post. And that white culture has taken the power to define all things good as white and all things white as good. If that was the case, how come saying it's okay to be white can get you fired from your job if all things white are good? Again, these people aren't thinking. So that definition of healthy eating is not an accurate depiction of health of eating healthy. Over the year, the woman in the beginning of the article, Gordon, shed 30 pounds and outgrew the need for some, I guess, machine she was wearing by making changes in her diet. So it was the cultural barriers that made a healthy lifestyle hard. How about just admitting that you're ignorant about things and learn and take the time as opposed to blaming other people? For a person who needs to retrain their mind and think differently about healthy eating, they're always going to be that struggle getting past this plate of white. For a person who needs to retrain their mind and think differently about healthy eating, that's always going to be their struggle getting past this is a plate of food. This plate of food is for a white person. Yeah, it just made it really just ridiculous. Healthy food has historically been less accessible to Black Americans in a number of ways. So does eating healthy have to be equated with eating like white people? According to a new generation of chefs, nutritionists, academics, and patients, the answer is no. I just read that thing before, a short paper, What It's Like to Eat Like a White Person. That was the one I read before here. The woman who wrote that article is describing white people food as salads, fruits, yogurts, cottage cheese, and lean meats. I would say a lot of those foods have just become typical Western foods. They're not really technically white people's foods. They're just technically Western foods. I mean, some of those foods do have roots in Europe, but a lot of those foods are very much just kind of American or Western foods. All right, scrolling down. So now after all that stuff that they talked about, you know, blaming whites, you know, for all this food stuff, then I scroll down here to the article and it says, African Americans are at much higher risk for a number of genetic predispositions and health issues, many of which are strongly influenced by diet. So it's almost like they're blaming their ill health, which could partially be biological, but a lot of it could be the biological reaction of their body to eat bad food. And they have a higher risk of diabetes, as well as high blood pressure. And they're more likely to be obese than whites. Blacks are 1.5 times more likely, American blacks. So that could just be the way their biology, their raciology is, you know, reacting to these foods. And these junky, disgusting foods have been marketed to all of us by Jews. Of course, they've done different marketing to the black community, but they do marketing of junk food to everybody. Look at the terrible commercials they have on the Talmud Vision, marketing disgusting cereal, you know, non-food to children. That's not black people specifically. That's a wide variety of all children that's being marketed to. So now they go on about talking about lack of black nutritionists. That's true. There are less, but there's probably more of that coming. And they talk about Michelle Obama's program about raising a healthy generation of kids. And again, talking still about people of color, things like that. And they're saying that soul food became a political term at some point. I mean, like I said earlier, soul food, a lot of people eat that stuff. Blacks, whites, it's more of a regional thing than a racial thing. Of course, some of those foods, I will say, like some of the really gross, kind of like, you know, whatever wouldn't be like the main muscle meats, like the weird organs and tail and the ears. Oftentimes that was slave food for the blacks. But let's think back to who brought them over here in the first place, right? So again, a lot of these arguments are really flimsy, but it's interesting to see how they're willing to blame us for pretty much anything. All right, that's enough of this article. And there are plenty of Instagram pages and things like that. It looks like they are run by black people, and there's plenty of healthy food on there. So it isn't anybody or everybody who's eating this junky diet. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next article. So basically, the conclusion that I have about that is just they're complaining about their health and they're blaming others for it. And Africa itself has plenty of unique food. It just is probably that a lot of American blacks who have been over here for generations aren't familiar with those foods of, you know, of their homeland. But a lot of that food is actually pretty varied and pretty tasty. And they might even think it was exotic if it was fed to them. So if anything, I think this is really just a lack of education and not anything really more than that, just besides the fact that they're getting all this crap food marketed to them, but we all are. So that is that with the anti-white stuff that I found about food. And then I found some stuff about food that was more of an idea of what we do eat or what other people think we eat. So I found this on Quora, and it was titled, What Foods Are Associated with White People? And this person describes themselves as a foodie who is listing these foods, and they're basically saying that sourdough bread and things like that are considered to be white. I would definitely say that's true. They also say the meat, potato, vegetable type of meal. That would be traditionally a lot of European cultures would have food like that. Also rice and things like that. I mean, a lot of these foods are foods that I don't really eat. Chicken noodle soup, chicken and dumplings, macaroni, cheese, tuna casserole. These are a lot of foods, I guess, associated with whites in America. Barbecue. And of course, I mean, when you think about white people's food, what most people think is white people's food, is really not the abundance of all the countries of Europe. I mean, there are so many different types of European cuisine. It's endless. I mean, most of us probably aren't too familiar with some of the tinier European countries and what they eat, but there's so much white food. It isn't just apple pie. This person saying these are typical American foods: hot dogs, burgers, ribs, mashed potatoes, tacos. That's not really white people's food, but okay. But yeah, there's just so much to it, and it seems like they're kind of labeling a lot of this bland or heavy stuff as our food, or they're taking the other route and they're labeling kind of this really fancy superfood stuff as ours. So either they're making fun of us and saying our food is bland, or they're saying that our food is too expensive and it's intimidating to other races, when plenty of white folks don't even have the money to afford to buy like a $9 kale water. Really, really crazy. And there's definitely, if you break it down from Northern, Eastern, and Central European, their diet's going to be a little more similar. And then you have Western Europe and Southern Europe, since they're warmer, they're going to have more warm foods. There's so many amazing, abundant foods in Europe, depending on where you are. Just a lot of those foods aren't too, I guess, readily available outside the house, or they're not being made, I guess, the proper way. Like when I think of the area that I live in, I mean, what do I see? Pizza, yogurt, bagels, Chinese food, sushi. Like this really isn't traditional European food for the most part. And the places that do serve that are very few of them around anymore. And it's usually pretty expensive or pretty heavy food for the most part. But we can definitely connect to our roots more by understanding more of what the food of our ancestors would be, depending on what country we hail from. I think that's always really important to know what your ancestors ate. I think that's a really good way to connect with your blood. We'll be right back.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at all the life. There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There was sand and hills and rain. The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground was dry, but the air was full of sound. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name, because there ain't no one for to give you no pain.
Kyle's paintings don't suck. They actually look like what they represent and don't have grotesque scenes and themes. In fact, they are a celebration of beauty and life. Sure, they might cost a few hundred dollars, but just imagine how much they will be worth after Kyle becomes even more famous or infamous. Either way, you win. And with inflation, we can almost guarantee each painting will one day be worth $6 million. Just imagine if you were able to get one of Hitler's paintings when no one knew who he was. Visit KylePaintings.com. Buy an already painted piece or commission one. Say no to degenerate art and yes to KylePaintings.com.
Thank you.
And we are back. And I was discussing what people perceive as a white people food and also what traditional European foods are. So now I wanted to move on and talk a little bit about some traditional European foods. And first, I wanted just to break it down by areas of Europe. So people who live in the northern, eastern, and central area, the typical foods for those folks would be potatoes, carrots, sourdough bread, rye bread, butter, sausage, dumplings, stews, creams, kind of more like cold weather type of food, dill. They also use herring, sauerkraut. And then Western Europe, they would have more roast casseroles, gravies, pâtés, stews, soups, leeks, radishes, and blended cheeses. And then Southern Europe would have more olives and olive oil, breads, cured meats, fresh seafood, tomato, vinegar, feta cheese, mozzarella, lemons, and limes. That's a kind of like a basic idea based on the climate, what those people would eat, what would grow there, and what they would need, I guess, from the cold weather perspective. Like when you think of the northern areas of Europe, they usually have richer food. They usually typically had more meat in their diet. And in the southern areas, they would have lighter food, sometimes things like seafood, less dairy, more vegetables would be abundant, more fresh herbs, things like that. So now just to break down, in case anyone isn't too familiar with what white people's food actually is, because there's so many amazing different European countries and foods that they have, I just wanted to kind of break this down so everyone gets an idea of it. So Central Europe, that would be Austria, Czech Republic, Germany, Hungary, Poland, Liechtensteiner, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Switzerland. And that would be kind of like a heavier type of food, like Wiener Schnitzel, which is an Austrian dish. They have a lot, they have a lot of more meats and creams and not too much fresh vegetables, I guess, just based on what they could grow, traditionally allowed to grow there. More cooked food as well. And then in the Eastern European region, not all of these countries, I would say, are 100% white, like Armenian, that they're not really white. Same with Azerbaijani, that's an area deep in Russia. Belarus, not so sure about that. Bulgaria, Georgian cuisine. Let's see, Moldovan, Romanian, Russian, Ukrainian. So that would be like the Eastern European style of food. And that tends to be like a lot of breads and things like that, a lot of things stuffed in breads, soups, things of that nature. And then you have Northern European cuisine, which is British cuisine, English, Northern Irish, Scottish, Welsh, Danish, Estonian, Faroese, I guess the Faroe Islands, Finnish, Icelandic, Latvian, Lithuanian, Norwegian, Sami, and Sweden. And this food, I guess, kind of, you'd say fish and chips. What else? Icelandic food, they use like a lot of rye and things like that, those types of breads. A lot of potatoes, too, in this fare. And then you have Southern Europe, which would be... not sure if all of these are white countries either. Albania, I didn't think was white. You have Bosnia, Croatia, Cyprus, Gibraltar, Greek, Italian, including Sicilian and Sardinian, two separate islands, Macedonian, Maltese, Portuguese, Serbian, Spanish, and then you have all the areas of Spain, and Turkish, which I also think are not white. And this food tends to be a little fresher, more herbs, more use of nightshade vegetables like tomato and eggplant and peppers and things like that. Pizza, more seafood heavy. And then finally, you have Western Europe, and that would be Belgium, Amsterdam, France, Luxembourg, and that would kind of be that cuisine, which tends to be, you know, typical French cuisine for the most part, fondues and things like that, bouillabaisse, which is a seafood stew, things of that nature. So if anyone is ever, you know, asked what white people's food is, that's really the food of Europe, all of those things that I mentioned in all those countries. And of course, any of these things I mentioned could be made in a healthier version, just using the technique and the seasonings and the vegetables. And you could take any of these dishes and you could reinvent it in a way healthier way. It's just something to think about. I'm always interested in making new types of cuisine and kind of, you know, just learning more about that. It's really fascinating. All right. Well, onward with that. Now I have a little bit more on the news section. And here's some news that I found about a week ago. Denver has decriminalized psilocybin, it looks like. Denver just voted to decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms. It's the first city in the U.S. to decriminalize psilocybin mushrooms. And this was on May 8th. This was just last week or so. I'm just going to read this little article about this. Makes sense that it would be Denver because they were one of the first states with cannabis. So makes sense that this would be next for them. Denver will become the first U.S. city to effectively decriminalize mushrooms containing the psychedelic psilocybin, also known as magic mushrooms. Initiative 301 makes the personal use and possession of psilocybin mushrooms among people 21 and older the lowest possible law enforcement priority in Denver. It also prohibits the city from spending resources to pursue criminal penalties related to the use or possession of psilocybin mushrooms among people age 21 and older. And the initiative sets up, quote, the Psilocybin Mushroom Policy Review Panel to assess and report on the effects of the ordinance. The initiative doesn't legalize magic mushrooms. They remain illegal under state and federal law, and it doesn't decriminalize or deprioritize enforcement against the distribution and sale of psilocybin mushrooms. All that could still be pursued by police. According to the Washington Post, Denver police arrested about 50 people last year over the past, arrested about 50 people a year over the past 3 years for possession or sale of psilocybin, and prosecutors acted on just 11 of the cases. That's out of thousands of arrests overall in the city each year. Voting began in Colorado, which does mail-in voting last month and mostly concluded Tuesday. Things look bad for the initiative late Tuesday, but then I guess they're saying it won narrowly by a 51% vote, and the results are being certified today, actually. Advocates of the measure argue the decriminalization would shift law enforcement resources away from pursuing nonviolent offenses. They claim that psilocybin is safe, non-addictive, or close to non-addictive, and that a growing body of evidence suggests the drug has therapeutic benefits for illnesses ranging from depression to end-of-life anxiety to addiction. Opponents worry that decriminalization could lead to more drug use. Especially in Denver, they're concerned that decriminalization could perpetuate the city's reputation as a drug-friendly city. Critics also point out psilocybin does have some risks, particularly, experts say, the possibility of accidents and traumatic experiences that can be psychologically damaging, especially among people predisposed to mental illness. Well, that's true. There's definitely a time and a place to utilize something like this. And I would say a lot of people probably aren't in at a head state where it would be appropriate for them. And this is not a party drug. So I'm not sure why they're worried about it leading to other drug use. And just calling it a drug is kind of ridiculous because it's a plant. It's like calling cannabis a drug. It just, it kind of changes how you think about it. One potential source of real world evidence is Portugal. After the country decriminalized all drugs, it saw a decrease in drug-related deaths and drops in reported past year and past month drug use, according to a 2014 report. But it also saw an increase in lifetime prevalence of drug use, as well as an uptick in reported use among teens after 2007. But Portugal also simultaneously adopted special commissions that attempt to link people with drug addictions to treatment. Okay, so they're saying that it could lead to people to use it. It really depends on the people, I suppose. I mean, I don't think any plant should be illegal. I think that's just kind of ridiculous to put a law on a piece of nature. It just kind of seems asinine to me. It's a very kind of Zog thing to do, obviously. But anyway, this is the latest news with psilocybin, and I'm sure other states are probably going to follow suit with this. This could be good or this could be bad. I mean, it probably will take a nefarious turn, but that's not to say that psilocybin doesn't have a time and a place, and it is a healing substance. All right, another piece of news that I found this week. I haven't tried this yet myself. I thought it was pretty cool. I have had oat milk, which I think is pretty good. So now there are some companies out there making oat yogurt. And since oats are one of the, I think it's actually of all the grains out there, I think it's the highest fat. So it makes for a nice milk because of that high fat content. So here's a little article about oat yogurt. Move over porridge. Oat yogurt is now the grain of choice for plant-based breakfast. So I would assume the texture of this would kind of be roundabout to like a soy milk or a coconut milk, which are also a little richer than, let's say, almond or hemp. Vegan yogurt is fantastic. Is a fantastic versatile food. Popular as a breakfast dish with fruit and cereal. It can also be enjoyed as a pudding, swirled into curries, or made into tzatziki or used in baking. Let's see. According to the Good Food Institute, a nonprofit organization which promotes the advancement of plant-based food and training meat, they're calling it clean meat, the plant-based milk industry is worth $1.8 billion. And I'm assuming that includes things like yogurt as well. In terms of, maybe not, oh, it doesn't. In terms of yogurt, it is predicted that this particular dairy-free industry will reach $7 billion by 2027. Maybe it is. I'm not really sure with that wording. Traditionally made with dairy and fermented with live cultures, the rise of plant-based eaters has led to new development in a moo-less yogurt, and oats are fast becoming a popular ingredient. I will note, though, that the majority of these non-dairy yogurts tend to have like gross stabilizers or some type of natural flavor. So it would be probably best to, I guess, make this at home eventually, if anything. So yeah, they're talking about the probiotics and how that's benefit to gut health. That's sort of that most people know. And then the benefits of oats, a mainstay, of course, in Europe. They're saying despite the humble reputation, the common oat is actually something of a supergrain. Originating in the Middle East's latter-day Fertile Crescent, the popular cereal has made its merry way to Europe and Britain. From the Middle Ages onward, oats became a mainstay for the peasant class, especially in Scotland, where the crop flourished in a damp climate. It makes me think of haggis, that Scottish dish where they take, I think it's the stomach of an animal, I'm not sure which one, and they stuff it with all types of, I guess, like meat bits, but they also, they put oats in it too. Oats are incredibly nutritious. Oats are packed with complete complex carbohydrate and 17% protein to boot. In addition, oats are also revered for their cholesterol-lowering properties, and they're also a good source of fiber. Just something else to think about, another you know, alternative milk that's hitting the market, so or yogurt rather, so, or if this one has natural flavors. It seems like I go to the store, and I don't know if anyone else is seeing this, but really, like, what is it, 95% of any like packaged good, even if it's organic or, you know, GMO free, they all have a natural flavor in it. It's like it's everywhere. Everything has it in it, like even things that don't even need it. It just makes you think, how bad do these things have to taste that they have to add in all that, you know, those natural flavors, which of course aren't just one ingredient. They could be up to 500 or more ingredients. And you just think it's, you know, one thing on the label. I was completely ignorant until I did some research on this. So when they are saying there are two oat yogurts out now. One's called Oddly Good. It's a Finnish brand. I'm not sure if it's going to be available here in America. And there's one called Nancy's. I know that brand. They make dairy stuff. So they're making an oat yogurt. So hopefully that one will be free of the natural flavors. And there's also a company called Beta, B-E-T-A. It's a Seattle company, and they're making one as well. All right, so something to think about. Another food to add to one's regime. And now I wanted to read a little article about some weeds that you can forage this time of a year. So three useful weeds to forage in early spring. And this is pretty cool. I didn't know about all of this. So here's a little article about what three herbs that can be foraged right now. And the first one is Japanese knotweed. Japanese knotweed first came to North America as an import to fill the niches of Central Park. Little did the designers of Central Park know what an incredibly and powerful invasive species Japanese knotweed would be in the North American ecosystem. If you live in the northeastern part of the U.S., especially, Japanese knotweed shoots will be incredibly easy to find once you know what you're looking for. So they're invasive species. They take over everything. You can find them on the sides of the roads in springtime. They can also be caked with a little bit of sand or salt. They grow near waterways and roadsides. And it is a food. They can be juiced, and supposedly they can be used as a medicine for Lyme disease. I did not know that. To use it as a simple food, you can treat knotweed the way you would treat a young asparagus or a rhubarb. They need to be peeled, the shoots, and they have a slightly woody sheath on the outside. Once that is done, it's as simple as steaming them, making them into a stir fry or utilizing them in casseroles. You could also make a strawberry vegan pie with it, I guess kind of how you would do rhubarb. Interesting. And it says another type of shoot very much like Japanese knotweed that you may find in the wilderness is wild asparagus. I've never seen that before, which will grow on the water's edge in fields and in the Rocky Mountain region of the U.S. or in the Pacific Northwest is where you can find that. I just wanted to see what it says about Lyme disease. Yeah, it's saying that with the knotweed, it's the cytokine. Let's see. It says that addressing Lyme disease beyond superficial treatment requires an understanding of the cytokine cascades and likely interactions between the coinfections. So this talks about how Japanese knotweed can be used to fight some of the inflammation that comes along with Lyme disease. That's pretty interesting. And Japanese knotweed root is considered antibacterial, antiviral, many things, antifungal, anti-inflammatory, a vasodilator, anti-mutagenic, the list goes on, analgesic, cardioprotective, astringent. There's a lot of good stuff with this plant. It enhances blood flow. That's why it's good for Lyme, because it can facilitate blood flow to areas that don't have a lot of blood flow, and that can help kill the organisms. It's also good for the gastrointestinal system as well. Something to think about getting, or to finding rather. And then the second one is burdock, which I've talked about before. Burdock is awesome. The burdock flower looks much like a thistle, and pollinators love it. So this is a bee-friendly food. The thistle is really pretty. It's almost like Velcro, too. If you rip them off and you throw them at someone's hair or shirt, they'll stick. I'm thinking probably the guy who invented Velcro maybe was around burdock. So burdock, where to find? It also likes to fill in the gaps in narrow driveways, between trash cans, sprouting up between asphalt and stuff like that. It's a very opportunistic plant, thriving especially in the central region of North America. And it kind of looks like a thin carrot. Like imagine if a carrot didn't come to a tapered bottom at the end and was just straight through the same thickness. That's what burdock looks like, but it's brown. Burdock root must be harvested in the early springtime for its medicinal benefits. Once the root becomes seasoned with the passing of summer, the medical constituents have moved on. You can dig up a small portion of the root, which should be cleaned, chopped, and dried. You can do this, you can dry it in an oven, like a pilot light on, or you can dry it if you have a dehydrator as well. This can be added to any recipe to make a purifying, detoxing tonic. I like to use it in a detox tea with dandelion root, nettle, and lemon. Burdock root excels at treating acne and can be made into a tea, cooled, and then used as a face toner or in a facial steam. And then the third food that we can forage for in the early spring is ostrich fern. And this fern shoot, also known as fiddleheads or fiddlehead ferns, because of their unique and uncanny resemblance to a literal fiddlehead, went through a bit of a gastronomical fad a couple of years ago. They're green and they're curled up. It's like a, almost looks like a nautilus shell or like the spiral of life. They're really pretty. They're good cooked with a, like a chopped white onions. So let's see. Ferns populate forest floors and wet spots, gently clustering their roots into a tight, inextricable crown that keeps the soil on the floor and available to their neighboring trees. Their leaves can serve as shelter for native insects, and as one of the oldest plants on the planet, they do a fantastic job of growing wherever they can. I've seen these growing in swampy areas myself, like areas that are kind of like marshy and wet. They're saying right here, they're especially easy to find in wet, acidic forests. They can tolerate growing under pine trees, but do best in slightly shaded forests near marshes, wetlands, and rivers. The fiddleheads will be growing close to the ground, much like knotweed shoots. They'll be pushing straight out of the soil where the fern's root systems have been hibernating for the winter. Look for a nice and tightly spiraling shoot with soft reddish-brown hairs that slough off easily. And you can basically follow the rules of asparagus when eating these. And asparagus, of course, is a thistle, right? So they're similar, I guess, to a fern. Fern shoots are a much needed food source in early spring. They can be steamed or boiled, add to a casserole. You could make a soup. There's amazing stuff you can do with it. So just an idea of maybe some things you can find foraging depending on where you live. And if you can't find them, foraging might be worthwhile just to try anyway, especially this knotweed. Some of these benefits were new to me, but I think I might explore adding this to my medicine cabinet. Okay, then I found this little story about extinct species, plant species to be exact, and just a little interesting small paragraph that kind of just got me thinking. And the article is titled, "Can We Coax Extinct Species Back into Existence?" And it tells a story about a farmer in Australia, just a short paragraph, but still very interesting stuff. About a dozen years ago, I heard a farmer present the results of his work on his decades-old biodynamic farm in Australia. He showed slides of the massive pit they had dug in which they laid dozens of cow horns filled with manure, which were used to, quote, enliven the fields. He shared how they made the biodynamic preparations that are at the heart of the biodynamic process. These preps stimulated calcium uptake by the plants, as well as root and fruit development, and others strengthened the plants against various diseases. But the main thing that stuck with me were that the slides he showed off of an insect on his farm that had been declared extinct a decade earlier. The farmer said he had heard such a thing was possible, but it was another thing to see this phenomenon with his own eyes and to document and the reintroduction of this insect. One could only sit back and wonder and awe. Of course, it is possible that the insect wasn't really extinct, that its numbers had just declined to an undetectable level. Still, this theory is especially poignant as news headlines are full of stories documenting the rapid rate and extinction of plants, insects, and animals in today's world. Of course, leaving out the rapid white genocide rate, just put that in there. But yeah, very interesting thing to think about, if something could come back, right? That's really quite fascinating. And then they reference Rudolf Steiner, who I think was a Jew. I'm not 100% on that. He's the one who's associated with those Waldorf schools, which are, I'm not a fan of at all. They seem like they're really not a good environment for children. The whole idea of children going to a place to learn outside of homeschooling or home learning doesn't really sit too well with me. But anyway, he said that if one diligently works to increase the life force on our land, not only will we get healthier food, but we'll also coax certain species back into existence. It's just something to think about, life force and things like that. He's also associated with the anthropomorphic movement. But yeah, I'm not advocating this person. I'm just thinking about that sentence about life force on the land, because right now our land doesn't really have a massive amount of life force being given to it most of the time. I mean, yes, you can do gardening and put back in and you can earth, but the life force is, I think, being kind of raped out of the land through all the chemical agriculture and the spraying of the skies and things like that. So if we could increase the life force, could we possibly bring back things that have gone extinct? Something to think about. All right, that's it for that article. I just kind of just put stuff together sometimes that I found throughout the week that I think are just interesting things for others to ponder. So I put them here in the show. Okay. Another article that I wanted to share. Let's just see if this oat yogurt has any natural flavors in it. Okay. They're not showing the ingredients. Oh, well, that's good. It looks like the plain one does not. Okay, we'll be right back.
Hearing all about Jews and their beloved Israel. This is America.
Hey, don't say that. Jews do so much for us and deserve our thanks.
Okay, so what do they do?
Although they are only 2% of the population, they are running our banks and overall monetary system, ensuring our children receive proper education and medication, entertaining us with TV, movies, magazines, and gossip, running some of our biggest corporations, including the big tech giants, weeding out awful hate speech, and promoting the rainbow of alternative lifestyles and gender identities, and funding the campaigns of our honorable and honest politicians.
Wow, they sure do a lot.
That's right. Don't be an anti-Semite. Let the chosen rulers of this world know you appreciate them.
Thanks, Jews!
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Just checking out to see if this oat milk has natural flavors. That's the Nancy's brand before the break. And all the non-plain ones do have natural flavors, which I'm not surprised. The plain one does not have natural flavors, but it does have coconut oil in it. So for anyone who's interested, those natural flavors are everywhere. All right, moving along now. So for the second half of the show, I had some other information in kind of a different direction. Tonight's show is just kind of a hodgepodge of different things and different stories that I found. So one thing I wanted to talk about is the origins of Ayurveda and the Aryan origins of Ayurveda. So some pretty interesting information. So here we go with this information. So here's a brief history of Ayurveda. Ayurveda has evolved over 5,000 years with its beginnings in the Himalayas. Around 800 BC, the first Ayurvedic school was established by a man named Punarvasu Atriya. He and his students recorded their medical knowledge. These writings inspired a scholar named Charaka 100 years later to write the Charaka Samhita, which details over 1,500 plant species and identifies 700 medicinal plant species. Traditionally, Ayurvedic practitioners still use this book as a reference guide. Charaka's second work, entitled Susruta Samhita, was the basis for modern surgery. Traditional Chinese, Tibetan, and Islamic medicine have their roots in Ayurveda. Ayurveda is one of the oldest modalities of traditional medical practices. Yes, it is. All right. So let me, actually, that's not the link I was looking for. Here it is. Okay. And looking at these people in, I guess, statues or even pictorial depictions that I just mentioned, and that would be, Maharishi Charaka and then Maharishi Susruta. Looking at these two people, these statues look pretty pretty white to me by their features and everything. Definitely no surprise there. So just wanted to read this little information about what they're calling the history of Indian medical science, and I'll rename that for us, and then we'll call it the history of Aryan medical science. Whenever the line Aryan medical science is uttered, we all automatically start imagining two of the legendary sages, Maharishi Susruta and Maharishi Charaka, who pioneered the ancient Aryan medical science. Medicine is such a vast and widespread field. Nowadays, every surgeon, doctor, nurses, and any other related to the medical field study tons of beliefs before they actually become a professional, and their profession directly affects the lives of people. In the present scenario, their studies and practice are carried under professionals, but sometimes they have to pay a huge amount to get certified by a professional. The medical heritage of India is oldest among all. There are evidences of surgical operations, curing diseases, and treatments of broken bones since the Vedic period. Then, in the 6th century BC and in 2nd century AD, the time came where the two great sages, Maharishi Sushruta and Maharishi Charaka, dominated Aryan medical science respectively. Ayurveda is true born of India by the likes of great pioneers and sages like Sushruta and Charaka. So here's a little bit about Maharishi Sushruta. Maharishi Sushruta was the founding father of surgery. He had conducted the variety of complex surgeries such as cesareans, artificial limbs, cataract, urinary stones, fractures, and his specialty was in plastic surgery. He is the author of the famous book Sushruta Samhita in Sanskrit language, which was earlier known as the Shaila Tantra. In it, he describes all the amazing surgical procedures with the accuracy and curative ability to produce intended results. He was the first person who had classified the surgical operations and explained the plastic surgery as well as its tools in his book of 120 chapters in 5 parts. He has described around 8 special operations for surgery, such as cutting, piercing, opening, scratching, inserting, and stitching. Today, we all know the word anesthesia and how it works. You will be amazed to know that the pioneer of anesthesia was Maharishi Sushruta, and has promoted the proper use of wine with the incense of cannabis for the anesthesia purpose. The use of henbane and samohini and sanjivani was started in a later period. Those are other herbs. It is said that the surgical instruments which he developed were so sharp that it could even split a single vertical human hair into halves. That reminds me of just how sharp those Clovis tools were that the Salutrians, or the Clovis people, made. So this just shows like fine crafting of Aryan people. Plastic surgery, and here's a little picture of him on the left doing some type of incision work on somebody. He has described all the basic principles of plastic surgery by offering a suitable physiotherapy before operation. This technique of the release of skin in order to cover all the defects, rotation of the flaps to heal the partial loss, and the pedicle flaps to cover the entire loss of skin from an area were well described by him. He has given various other methods together with the sliding graft, rhinoplasty, rotation graft, labioplasty, and pedicle graft in his Samhita. And here's the other man, Maharishi Charaka, and they're showing a statue of him. Also looks very white. Maharishi Charaka has been crowned as the father of medicine. He was a principal contributor to the ancient art and science of Ayurveda. He wrote the well-known book Chakara Samhita, which is considered the encyclopedia of Ayurveda. When the science of anatomy was confused with different theories in Europe, Acharya Charak revealed through his genius and inquiries the facts on human anatomy, embryology, pharmacology, blood circulation, and diseases like diabetes, tuberculosis, heart disease, etc. In the Charaka Samhita, he has described the medicinal qualities and functions of nearly one lakh herbal plants. Maybe that's a typo. It says L-A-K-H. He has emphasized the influence of diet and activity on mind and body. He has proved the correlation of spirituality and physical health contribute greatly to the diagnostic and curative sciences. Now we know the origins of medical science in India. Also, the world knows that the pure form of treating any patient is given by Ayurveda, which covers not only to cure, but also describe their causes and removes the symptoms from its root, helping the patient recover from any diseases and any surgical treatment if needed. And of course, allopathic medicine or allopathetic medicine, Western medicine, never gets to the root, ever. It's all about just getting rid of the symptoms, but never finding out what the root cause is. And here's a little bit about allopathy. No wonder we are all crazy about allopathy medicines, as it is quick acting and gives instant results in curative diseases or surgical treatment. But it has side effects, which sooner or later will show its true colors. So yeah, that's technically true. Like, let's say You take an herbal version of something, that may take a little bit more time to show its results, but it's going to be true results as opposed to just taking some pharmaceutical or some over-the-counter pill, which you may get super quick results, but you can possibly deal with liver damage and insomnia and weight gain, et cetera. So, you know, to be patient and work with the plant always makes good sense to me. There are many forms of treating along with Ayurveda, like homeopathy, allopathy, and many more. Ayurveda is totally based on the findings of Maharishi Sushruta and Maharishi Charaka, which was the great contribution in the history of Aryan medical science. So just a little bit of information about that. That was really interesting. Just find about the kind of like more of the surgical side of Ayurveda. I've always more associated Ayurveda with the doshas and herbs and different regimes for, you know, different body types, constitutions, things like that, or different ailments. So to see kind of the beginnings of surgical technique is pretty interesting. And it sounds like it was done with herbs to complement it, as opposed to some disgusting pill that has a synthesized version of an herb that's also going to cause all types of symptoms. So just interesting to see the origins of something like this. Let's see if there's anything else that I could find about this. I had saved a couple of links about this. Okay, this article is actually pretty interesting too. This talks more about the origins of Ayurveda. The origins of Ayurveda are recalled through an oral myth-based tradition which recounts that this type of healing came directly from God, I guess they're saying, or nature or something like that. I think when people say God, a lot of times they're just giving an anthropomorphic feel to the essence of nature. A sage named Bharadvaja learned the secrets of medicine, they're saying, from one of the gods, and then taught his compounded wisdom to a group of sages. Then these sages taught aspects of it to their greater disciples. So it sounds like people who were the most connected to the god essence or to nature basically became the sages or the rishis that taught these aspects to other people. A great rishi and master healer of ancient India was named Punavarsu Atriya, and he had six disciples who also became masters of healing. One of his disciples, Anigvisha, created a compendium book on the teachings of Atreya. Later in 1st century CE, CE, a physician by the name of Charaka, which I had mentioned just a little while ago, compiled and edited the original manuscript by Anigvisha and made additions to it. So here you can see the lineage kind of going down, more people adding to Ayurveda. In this format is known as the Charaka Samhita. This massive tome of wisdom has approximately 1,990 varieties of medicinal plants listed, each one having gone through an extremely rigorous process of empirical testing before it was eligible to be included in the book. That's amazing. I haven't even learned about that many herbs myself thus far. That's amazing stuff. Sushruta, in about 1000 BCE, create a pivotal textbook inspired by the father of surgery, Dhanvantari, also known as the god of Ayurveda. This textbook is known as the Sushruta Samhita. It is astonishing to know that hundreds of years before Ayurveda became a systemized form of medicine, specialists were already performing intricate surgery for many types of medical problems, including the head, inner organs, and even plastic surgery to repair ears, eyes, and nose. So they weren't doing plastic surgery to alter someone's looks drastically, which it seems to be quite a trend nowadays. They were doing it in a corrective form, not so much a, you know, kind of like a morphing. The Charaka Samhita and the Sushruta Samhita were two textbooks used as a base for understanding medicine in all eight forms at great universities in India, such as the two first universities in the world, Takshashila which was from between 700 BC to 500 CE, and Nalanda, 500 CE to 1300 CE. The Charaka Samhita recounts a dialogue between many physician sages gathered in the Himalayas who held impassioned debates about the science of healing. Each time they reached a unanimous decision, the finding would be included in their timeless system of medicine. They decided to call this system Ayurveda, meaning the science of life or the art of living. Another great name in the history of Ayurveda is Chakrapanidatta, who lived, I guess, in 1038, who was King Laxman's physician. He wrote a compendium called Chakradutta, which is thought to hold the very essence of Ayurveda. There are many more authors of great repute who have added their wisdom to the river of Ayurveda over hundreds of years. It's saying that the Buddha had some influence on Ayurveda as well. His reputation is debatable to me because he did walk away from his family to pursue an ascetic life. And it would have been better if he had made that decision before he had a family, because it's pretty foul to walk out on a family like that. His meditation-based teaching, I guess, dispels gods and the caste system. So I guess they're saying he got rid of the caste system. He paved the way for folk medicine of India to let go of the trappings of superstition. I don't know too much if that is the case. So this is rather interesting. Here are the eight branches of Ayurveda. And some of this was new to me. So the first branch is called Kaya Chikitsa, and that is general medicine, which includes all the organs. And then there is Shalakya, which is treatments of the head and neck, including the ears, eyes, throat, nose, and mouth. Kind of almost sounds like a ear, nose, and throat doctor. Like I said, they're including the eyes as well. So an obstetrician and an ENR doctor. Shalya, that's surgery. Bhuta Vidya, that's spiritual healing for mentally based or supernatural based phenomena not explainable by normal medical logic. Then you have Kaumara Bithritya, which is the healing of children, followed by Agha Dantantra, which is using antidotes to treat poisons of all kind. Then Rasayana, which is wellness and rejuvenation treatments. And finally, Vajkarana, which is sexual healing and the enhancement of libido and fertility. And Ayurveda inspired Syrian, Babylonian, Chinese, Tibetan, Japanese, Greek, and other medicinal orientations. Just as Ayurveda has been benefited from streams of wisdom coming from outside of India, such as healing approaches from the Middle East. Well, our people have roots in the Middle East too, so maybe we made our way from there to the Indian subcontinent. And here is a wonderful quote which sums up the Ayurvedic approach to medicine. This comes from the teacher of Sushruta. Ayurveda has two purposes: to release the ill from illness and to serve the health of the healthy. And that's completely the antithesis of allopathy, which is all about getting a lifetime customer and managing disease. So complete opposite. This wants to set you free and have you be as healthy as possible. And allopathy is just about slowly milking you until you die. Let's see if there's anything worth else reading in here. This is also interesting to me, just finding out more about this system and how there's so many different branches of it, to think about the origins of these types of things. It talks a little bit about more Ayurveda with dosha. I've gone over, I guess, most of this on other shows as it is. So that's that for this article. All right. So many pop-ups. No, I don't want to subscribe. And Ayurveda is basically about drug-free living. That's Ayurveda in a nutshell, which is also the direct opposite of allopathy, which is all about living with drugs. So yeah, most of this is just, I guess, a repeat from what I've already read. So yeah, just more information about Ayurveda and, you know, herbs and wisdom like that, all good stuff. All right, moving along. So I wanted to talk a little bit about royal jelly, which I guess might be controversial for some people if they have problems with honey, because royal jelly is even more of a concentrated food than honey, but it has a lot of health benefits. It's a little pricey, a little on the expensive side. It's really, I would view it as medicine. I mean, I guess honey is medicine to an extent as well, especially if it's, you know, really, really good stuff. And hopefully, you know, it's really only worth consuming the really good stuff. But royal jelly is something that I've experimented with, and I think it gives really good energy, and it has benefits for all types of people. So here's just a little bit about royal jelly. And just to keep in mind, you can get it in a lot of different forms. You can get it fresh, frozen, shipped, which is really the only way to have it, and you store it in the freezer. Because if you're getting it in the like pills or capsules, or if it's in the blend with something else, chances are that it's not that fresh. And a lot of the benefits have probably been kind of minimized. So if I was going to recommend someone to source it, definitely get it frozen and then just, you know, shipped to you frozen on ice. And then you can keep it in your freezer. And you only need to use the tiniest amount, like half a teaspoon, quarter of a teaspoon. So even though it can be a little expensive, a jar will last you a long time. So here's this article, How to Fight Disease, Optimize Health, and Thrive. The health benefits of royal jelly are extensive, and universities around the world are studying this magical compound more and more frequently in an attempt to further understand it. I am a believer. I've been taking royal jelly for years, and it's no doubt in my mind that it has helped enhance many aspects of my life. The health benefits of royal jelly sometimes seem too good to be true. There are simply so many health conditions that this natural compound can help with. There is no question that it helps me as an overall vitality tonic. Yeah, I would definitely say it's definitely just a good overall tonic, as well as aiding in hormonal balance. The ultimate test to determine whether a supplement is right for me is when I go off it. How do I feel? Do I feel better when taking the supplement? That is a good question to ask yourself, definitely. When I perform this test with royal jelly, I noticed a drop in energy and a general sense of well-being. I found I slept better when I started taking it again and recovered faster from my workouts as well. And my skin just didn't seem as healthy when I didn't when I wasn't taking it. So I went back on the royal jelly. Okay, scrolling down. And here are the top 10 benefits of royal jelly. Number 10, antioxidant power. Antioxidants are all the rage these days because they help with cell oxidation, which the more cell oxidation you have, greater instance of cancer, heart disease, and other degenerative conditions. So royal jelly happens to be very rich in numerous antioxidants. So that's number one. And of course, like I said, get it, you know, fresh, frozen, shipped, and then keep it in the freezer. Number nine, is that it's an immune modulator. It's being indicated to have immunomodulatory potential for humans, says a study at the University of Rikuis in Japan. It helps with autoimmune disorders as well, such as rheumatoid arthritis, as well as many allergies. And I think it's also saying it's good for people who have lupus as well. Eight, brain function enhancement. That's one of the best things about it, is that you can experience a mild euphoria or a feeling of clarity upon taking royal jelly. This is protective to the brain, but it's also stimulate a cognitive function reaction and helps to repair the brain. So you're more likely to feel more alert and awake when you take it. And this, since you do get that alert, awake feeling, this is best taken in the morning as part of a morning routine. I wouldn't recommend taking this in the evening unless maybe you need to maybe stay up or something like that. And here are some other benefits, a little kind of infographic in the middle of the article. the top 12 benefits of royal jelly. Controls cholesterol, protective from breast cancer, because it might protect you from cancer-causing effects of environmental estrogens found in plastic and cosmetics. It's also good for osteoporosis and bone loss because it enhances calcium absorption. It's good for blood sugar, so it's good for diabetes or, you know, just controlling blood sugar. It's really good for the skin because it has a real plethora of vitamins, including B1, B2, B3, B5, B6, acetylcholine, zinc, and it boosts skin healing, and that boosts collagen production. So oftentimes, the best thing to do with this, I'll just interject here with a little bit of a tangent, but this whole trend with the collagen protein powders, which is going strong for a couple of years now. I bought into that Zogwash at one point in the past, but that's not really what you want to do. You don't want to take collagen. You want to consume foods that will boost your collagen production. That's really the best way to get healthy food, because one of the nasty side effects of taking those collagens is that they kind of grow your bones. So you're more likely to get things like bone spurs and bunions and stuff like that. So always better to consume a food that will boost your collagen production as opposed to just consuming collagen, which is very, I guess, hot with those paleo or keto diets. Another benefit of royal jelly is that it reduces inflammatory markers and could possibly help with pain. It protects the liver from the many toxins that it processes. Good for brain health, said that before. Okay, good for memory. Also good for fertility because it's a hormonal tonic. So a little bit more about the liver. It says simply drinking tap water today can expose your liver to over 200 toxic compounds. That's crazy. Well, I hope everyone's filtering their water, but just to know that royal jelly will help with your liver is a good thing to know. Inflammation, of course. All right, we'll be right back.
Presents Judah P. Benjamin, the first professing Jew to be elected the United States Senate. Judah. See how efficiently he ran his sugarcane plantation with 140 slaves. Judah. Imagine his courage as he resigned from the United States Senate to serve as Secretary General, Secretary of War, and later as Secretary of State for the Confederacy. His image is on Confederate money. Judah. Watch as Jews help in a spectacular escape after the war ended, and enjoy how the Rothschild dynasty rewarded the first Jew in the U.S. Senate for protecting their financial investment in the African slave industry and effort to destroy the United States. Judah. Coming this fall.
And we are back. And I was just discussing the benefits of royal jelly before the break. And now I'm going to switch gears to another topic. So I found this book in my many books that I have. And it's a pretty interesting book. It's from 1942, I believe. Yeah, it is. So it's a little bit older than a lot of other books, I guess, maybe on this topic. But it's called Strange Customs of Courtship and Marriage. And I'm going to go through a couple of the stories in this book just to give an idea of just how different all the races are and just how crazy some of these wedding traditions are and just how they just seem like they're very much infected with Abrahamic virus, with a lot of these taboos, just terrible treatment of women and things like that, and how this is not of our people, but to see that this is the way a lot of the world, unfortunately, behaves. It's really very abusive and cruel. So I'm just going to go through some of these ones. I just kind of put some notes, little post-it notes throughout the book and skimmed. There really wasn't an index, so I couldn't just search by keywords to find certain things about certain groups or races. So I had to just kind of go through the book and find what I thought was interesting to share. And books like this, which are written in 1942, I'm hoping have a little bit more truth in them than anything that would be written now, which would be kind of full of all types of nonsense. So first, I want to start with a story about the symbolism of rice and how that relates to marriage. And it also kind of gives some information about how this relates to how what our ancestors would do back in Europe. So I'll begin. The symbolism of rice. The custom of throwing rice or other grain after a departing bridal couple goes back to a very ancient times and is almost worldwide. Rice is traditionally symbolic of fertility or productiveness and is used at weddings, and its use at weddings evidences the wish of fruitfulness for the union. Among peoples whom rice was not available, wheat, corn, or other grain served the same purpose, the symbol of fecundity. The ancient Greeks were accustomed to pour flour and sweetmeats over the bride and groom as an expression of a wish for an abundance of all that is good and sweet and desirable. Fruits and nuts have likewise been widely used, especially in the Mediterranean countries, as a symbol of fruitfulness. In India, the throwing of rice can be traced from its earliest literature down to the present day. The poet Kalidasa describes how Prince Aja and his bride, sitting on a golden chair, were strewn with the wet grains of barley, first by young Brahmins and then by the king and all his relatives, and finally by noble women. It was the custom in 17th century England to cast wheat over the head of a bride when she came from the church. In the north of England, one of the oldest inhabitants of the neighborhood, who had been stationed on the threshold of the bride's new home, throws a plateful of shortbread over her head so that it falls outside. A scramble ensues among the friends of the married couple for the pieces, and it is deemed very fortunate to get a piece of the shortbread. Kind of sounds like the bouquet ritual, which supposedly was based on a ritual circumcision, and then the skin was thrown into the audience, and whoever, I guess, caught the foreskin would be the first person to bear a son. I hope that this English tradition is not tied to that. In Gloucestershire, at the beginning of the 18th century, a large cake was broken over the heads of a couple. In northeastern Scotland, when the bride passed over the threshold, there was held over her head a sieve containing bread and cheese, which were distributed among the guests or sometimes scattered around her, in which case there was a scramble by the young folks to secure a piece. At times, an oatmeal cake was broken over her head, and in later days, a thin cake of shortbread called the bride cake was substituted for it. This, too, was distributed among the guests, who carefully preserved it, particularly the unmarried. Variations of the customs persist to this day in England, Scotland, and Ireland. They are, of course, closely related to the throwing of rice or grain, ingredients from which the objects thrown are made. A sieve, of which frequent use is made in marriage ceremonies, is also regarded as a symbol of fecundity. As among more primitive savages, The throwing of rice is thought to have originated in the desire to appease evil spirits and keep them from doing injury to the bridal pair. So that's, to me, right there kind of sounds like an Abrahamic superstition type of thing. And didn't hear that prior in this reading. It was the primitive belief that evil spirits were always present at the marriage, so food was offered to propitiate these unseen malignant influences. Definitely sounds like an Abrahamic virus, that type of thinking. Numerous devices have been employed to drive demons and wicked genii, G-E-N-I-I, from the house where the wedding takes place from the nuptial bed. In old Russia, doors, windows, and chimneys were tightly closed at a wedding in order to keep out the witches. Shooting off guns and fireworks to remove the power of evil spirits in an ancient practice of people as far removed as Southern European to the Chinese. This could all be, after Inquisition times and things like that. Other primitives offer rice as an inducement to the soul of the bridegroom to remain with the bride. A widespread belief prevails in the Celebes, I don't know where that is, that the soul of the bridegroom, unless bribed, may fly away at marriage and never return. Rice is thus scattered over him to prevent the flight of his fickle soul. Even the act of eating rice together out of a common bowl constitutes marriage among some primitives. Among nearly all savages, the function of eating together symbolizes friendship, kinship, and peace. To eat with a stranger automatically makes him akin. Eating together out of the same bowl or dish signify the closest possible relationship, a spiritual or physical union, or marriage. Marriages generally in some of the Malyan and neighboring communities are completely carried out by the mutual eating of rice. Just a little bit about that type of ceremony. Now I wanted to read a little bit about circumcision, or better known as genital mutilation, and how that is considered to be a prerequisite of marriage for certain people. The importance of circumcision in a limited culture of primitive peoples is attested by the fact that it is conceded to be the oldest surgical operation. Furthermore, it is still the most widely practiced form of surgery and the only one having a mystical or religious significance. Maybe it isn't the oldest surgical operation. Thinking of what I had just read with the Ayurvedic medicine, maybe it's the oldest form of Abrahamic surgery. Maybe that would be a more accurate description. Leaving aside the general practice among the Jews, Mohammedans, and certain Christian sects, such as the Abyssinians, the Bogos, and the Copts, we are here concerned only with it as a rite incident to marriage. Among the tribes that so consider it are some of the natives of the west coast of Africa, the Kafirs, nearly all the peoples of Eastern and Central Africa, Madagascar, the Aborigines of Australia, Melanesia, the Indian archipelago, Polynesia, and many of the Indian tribes of the Western Hemisphere. There is undoubtedly magic significance attached to it among these peoples, as there was to its origin among the Jews, Mohammedans, and those Christian sects who considered it a religious rite. That it was originally considered the physical symbol of spiritual purification is indicated by several references in Romans 2, of which it was only necessary to quote the following: and circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit, not in the letter. Verse 29. The importance of the rite among primitive peoples undoubtedly rests on the fact that it makes a boy a man. That's crazy thinking. And gives him the appearance of sexual maturity. This in turn signifies he is capable of procreation, thus enabling him to fulfill his duties in marriage. If it results in this outward appearance, then, the logic of the primitive mind, there must be some favorable connection between the practice and the benign spirits. And in a lot of these cultures, from what I know, they circumcise like it when you're much older. I'm against it, obviously, 100% at any age, but much older is going to be, I guess, probably more painful. I mean, I can't say, but it's crazy. In those communities where circumcision is a prerequisite of marriage, eligible girls would not think of considering an uncircumcised youth as a prospective mate. The folkways with respect to this custom are so thoroughly established that it would be thought indecent and objectionable to show encouragement to a youth who had not yet been initiated by undergoing this tribal rite. Among the many peoples of Africa and certain natives of the Malay archipelago and South America, the girls also undergo a ritual analogous to circumcision, which is also looked upon as a necessary preliminary to marriage. Whether the presence applies to one or both sex, it is always a serious obligation, one of the most sacred rites performed by the tribe. Insane. So before people are set to procreate, they have to mutilate one of the most sensitive parts of their body. Crazy. Okay. Moving along with that. All right, so here's a little bit about the marriage among the ancient Hebrews and just how the status of women is pretty much same as animals. The position of women among the ancient Hebrews was an unenviable one, as it was among the most primitive pastoral peoples. Same story for today, modern day. However, as our own ethical and religious systems evolve from the Hebraic culture, that's a shame, we often overlook this fact, especially as many of the disabilities under which women has labored through the centuries have been condoned by our Christian, Judeo-Christian civilization. Sumner reminds us that the Jewish idea of marriage was naive and primitive. The purpose was procreation. There seemed to have been little ceremony about marriage beyond the fact that the suitor induced the father to surrender the daughter in return for gifts. The bride had no choice in the matter, whatever, and as this was the custom of her time, she did not expect to be consulted. In a word, it was marriage by purchase and sexual union, as indicated in Genesis 29, was the only principal marriage rite. No priestly function was necessary. The arrangements having been completed, the man took the woman as wife by repeating the formula, "Be thou consecrated to me," which was later extended to, "Be thou consecrated to me by the law of Moses in Israel." In the rabbinical period, the betrothal and wedding were united. Afterwards, the bride was led or carried to the house of the groom in a procession with dancing and rejoicing. 10 guests, adult males, must be present in the groom's house as witnesses, where prayers were recited and a feast enjoyed. At one period, 2 bridesmen led the couple to the nuptial chamber where they watched over them until after the conjugal union. So there's a bunch of people. Someone was just purchased for a marriage, and there's a bunch of people just watching the sex. The purpose of this was that there might be a witness to the consummation of the marriage, which was held all important and not merely to the wedding ceremony. When the custom of the presence of witness in the bridal chamber became objectionable in later times, a tent was substituted for the chamber. Later, a scarf, ceremoniously spread over the heads of the pair, took the place of the tent. The low status of women in ancient Hebrew society is further evidenced by the fact of the 10 commandments of the Old Testament are addressed exclusively to men. In the 10th commandment, the woman is mentioned together with the domestic servants and the domestic animals. The man is warned to not covet his neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is his neighbor's. Women, then, is treated rather as an impersonal object, a piece of property that man should not covet in someone else's possession. 6. The geniastic admonition, be fruitful and multiply, exercised an immense influence over the ancient Jews. The sexual function is therefore emphasized as a fulfillment of the first divine command to mankind. It is the realization of God's will for a peopled world. The pious Jew still reads in his book of prayer. And so our Creator and Maker ordered us to be fruitful and multiply, and whoever does not engage in reproducing the race is likened unto one who is shedding blood, thus diminishing the essence of the deity, and he is the cause that the Holy Spirit shall depart from Israel. His sin is great indeed. Just as it was sinful to abstain from marriage, it was also unlawful to live childless in a marital estate. One was not permitted to marry a woman too old or too young to bear children. If, after a period of years, the wife bore no children, the husband was obligated to divorce her and marry another who would bring him offspring. The man who destroyed the powers of procreation was twice a murderer. Even he who was born sterile had no place in the religious communal life. A Jew was forbidden to castrate even an animal. But with this preoccupation with sex, the ancient Jews held to the almost universal primitive taboo that stigmatized women as unclean, and the biological process of menstruation and childbirth necessitated purification and penance. And for anyone who's familiar with, you know, just their menstrual rituals for the Hasids, Sinead did a show on that a while ago. It's crazy what these people do in regards to that. It's insane. There was thus an inescapable paradox. Sex was both right and wrong, righteous and sinful. The burden of the dilemma could only be made bearable by the most precise law governing the situation. So here they are making laws to kind of like, I don't know, coax their insanity. In Talmudic lore, the conduct of the married couple during the woman's menstruation is elaborately formulated. As the punishment for sexual relations during the menstrual period is ultimately death for both the husband and wife, means were devised to guard them from temptations that might lead them to commit this horrible sin. Consequently, it was prescribed that the two must not show an affection toward each other during this time. The husband must be careful not to touch his wife, even without any desire. He must not even hand her anything so small that it could cause their fingers to meet. He may not eat out of the same dishes with her, nor drink from her cup, but she may eat and drink out of the dishes that he has used. He may not sit upon her bed, even in her absence, and she is not permitted to make his bed in his presence. He must not even see any part of her body that is customarily covered. Really very crazy. Leviticus 12 dwells on the problem of purification after childbirth in the following manner. Let's see if this is worth reading. Yeah, basically you're going to be unclean for 2 weeks is what you're saying. And I also know from what I've read from the Talmud that every non-Jewish female is born in what's called a state of Nida, which is eternal filth. So from the time any of us were born, we're going to be in an eternal state of filth. I guess if you're a Jew, it's only like a halfway state of filth. The low status of a woman is shown here with the whole belief of her being unclean, and not only by the curse of her uncleanliness itself, but in the statement that the impurity is twice as great with the birth of a female child than that of a male child. Manhood and fatherhood are joyfully exempt from these penalized disabilities. Furthermore, the newly married woman was obliged to be able to prove, clothes in hand, that she was a virgin at the moment of her marriage. And if the charge of not being a maiden was sustained, she was subject to stoning to death by men in her city, as described in Deuteronomy 22:13-21. It may well be said that in citing these extreme instances of discrimination against and hardness towards women, we are going a long way back in the social calendar. This is naturally true because our subject in this chapter is primitive religion. Okay, so as you can see, very ill beliefs right there. And then this was kind of interesting. This was in medieval Europe times, and they show a picture. And supposedly during the medieval time in Europe, they had this thing called medieval domestic relations court. And I'm just going to read this little blurb. In medieval times, sometimes a man and his wife settled a serious marital argument by fighting a duel before a court. The man was made to stand in a hole, while his wife was permitted to stand free above him. And here they show a picture of a man in a hole and a woman standing next to him. Each held a stout club. Whoever won the fight was pronounced legally justified by the judge. That's pretty brutal. All right. Just moving along with this. Let's see what else. Kind of coming to the end of the show here. I'm just going to skim through this book and see what is most worth finishing out with. Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff in here. A lot of it very sickening, too. These beliefs and taking people by force, just really insane types of stuff. All right, I think I'll read this thing about taboo. The meaning of the sex taboo. And the word taboo means forbidden, and it was a word adopted from the Polynesian, the original spelling being T-A-B-U. The practice of taboo is found under various names all over the world, but nowhere has it been so systemized as in Polynesia. It is an important and almost all-important factor in the lives of all known savage and barbarian tribes. It is an integral part of all primitive religions. It was almost equally momentous in the lives and religious observances of the ancient Hebrews, the Hindus, the early Christians, and the Mohammedans. And now they talk about certain taboos. So taboos are held on other things because it is considered that they bode ill. The list of such tabooed persons and objects is almost limitless, taking into consideration the vagaries of different peoples, but the taboos on injurious or destructive influences seem principally concerned with such things as a dead body, a newborn child, blood, particularly a woman's blood, and therefore women in general, because of the menstrual cycle, is associated with the loss of virginity and the phenomenon of childbirth. The sick, outcasts, and sometimes foreigners or criminals, animals, even words and names, and many other things at one time or another can be considered taboo. Taboos can be considered permanent or temporary, private and public. Okay. And what is not taboo is what's considered Noah, N-O-A, which is considered something that's actually common, so it's a non-taboo. So here's some information on the taboo of women. The belief that a woman's blood is fatal to a man leads at stated periods to a temporary taboo of women, even among civilized Hindus. For the same reason, many countries, men are not allowed to eat with women. At menstruation, women are forbidden to touch the food of men or their utensils. It is only by understanding the mana principle with the belief. What's mana mean? Let's see. I'm not sure. Industry of mana. I guess energy, maybe, or fear. I think fear. Yeah, okay. With the belief in sympathetic magic that is bound up in the concept, we can obtain an insight to an almost universal custom of the woman shunned under certain conditions and the sex taboo among primitive people. The avoidance of menstruating women, so widespread throughout the primitive world, was undoubtedly due to the belief that this function was a demonic possession. A woman during this period was held to be unclean and possessed by a demon. Primordial man could not be expected to know that the phenomenon of menstruation was in any way associated with reproduction. When the association was ultimately discovered, the taboo had become a fixed practice in social life, and such established customs are not dropped merely because their reasons for their origin have become known. Furthermore, by this time, the reason for their origin has long since been forgotten, so the practice remained valid for all sufficient reason that it was a custom. And I think that's the opposite of what is true, obviously, demonic possession for a menstrual period. This is a very sacred time of the month for a woman. It's not demonic possession. Again, this sounds like some kind of like Semitic viral filth. Among the Maoris, if a man ate food cooked by a menstruating woman, he would be taboo to an inch thick. An Australian native, and I'm assuming they mean an Aboriginal, who discovered that his wife had lain on his blanket at her menstrual period, killed her for violating the taboo, and then died of terror himself within a fortnight. Death is indeed the penalty dealt to a menstruating woman who dares to touch anything that the men use, or even walk on a path that is frequented by men. The primitive man's fear of women at the time of her sexual crises, I wouldn't call it that either. I would say just, you know, parts of the journey. And they're saying these crises are menstruation, pregnancy, and childbirth, is really but an intensification of his attitude towards her at all times. Yeah, I would agree. All of these kind of fear of this is kind of like rooted in misogyny. If she is possessed by demons on these occasions, how can he be sure that she is entirely free of evil influences at any other time? Notwithstanding all the precautions that are taken to purify her and drive out the malignant spirits, he is not entirely reassured, so a woman remains suspect. No small part of the elements involved in this belief in witchcraft and the horrors of the witch burning in civilized countries of the Western world, as recently as within the past two or three centuries, was due to this latent feeling. So I'll stop there today in regards to this book, just sharing interesting information about taboos and strange marriage rituals. So really crazy stuff, kind of like viewing women as, you know, inhuman and all this terrible, sick, insane Abrahamic belief. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of the program for this evening. I hope you found it interesting and perhaps learned something. Yeah. So always kind of deciphering things and seeing, you know, what is Aryan abundance and what is Semitic scarcity, because we're living in a world where we need to kind of work towards creating more Aryan abundance every day so we can lessen these, you know, these fear beliefs, these scarce beliefs, these sick, chemical, inauthentic, anti-nature beliefs that seem to be permeating a lot of the world, very unsavory stuff. So any way that we can be abundant, whether it be sharing information with other people, planting food in the ground, eating well, spending time in nature, sharing information with other people. Those are excellent examples of Aryan abundance. So I would encourage everybody to engage in some type of abundant practice on a daily basis, no matter what it is. It's a good routine for yourself, and it's a great way to share information with other people. No matter who they are, there's always a talking point with people. You just talk to them about things that they're comfortable talking about. You don't have to.
Herbs have been used by people since the dawn of time. When Rockefeller introduced allopathic medicine, many herbal remedies fell by the wayside as people put their faith in prescription pills and the world just gets sicker. Here at Heathen Herbs, we look to the past and to nature for answers. We offer tinctures, magnesium skin cream, lip balm, tooth powder, colloidal silver throat spray, and more. Check us out at heathenherbs.com.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. You know the night's magic seem to whisper and hush. You know the soft moonlight.